The Tom Woods Show, episode 508.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Don't let opportunity pass you by. The internet is handing you opportunities on a silver platter. With Code School, you can learn a skill that's in heavy demand in your spare time, namely web technologies and web development, and learn it enjoyably and cheaply. Get your free account at tomwoods.com/code. Welcome to another episode of the Tom Woods Show. We had a wonderful event at the Mises Circle in Dallas last weekend. We had a whole bunch of people there who got in for free because of the offer right here on the show. If you were a listener and you wanted to be at that event, you didn't have to pay the $95 entrance fee. And I didn't promote that on social media or through my newsletter or anywhere other than through the spoken word on the show to make sure we're talking about actual listeners. So listeners got that great benefit, and what a wonderful time we had. What I want to do for you now is play the talk that I gave on that subject, on political correctness, because that was the topic of the event. And in particular, I was talking about the worldview of the politically correct movement, which is that when you have differences in outcomes between groups, this can only mean that something sinister is at work. So if you have differences in incomes or job placement or whatever, this means something sinister is afoot. There's so-called discrimination, and discrimination leads to poverty and so on and so forth. And what I show in this talk is how absurdly simplistic a view that is. And what I'm trying to say, and I say it sometimes maybe in a way that's too subtle, you'll hear it if you're paying attention, but I want to make clear in here that if we're talking about, for example, black Americans, and we say that black Americans are underrepresented in, let's say, college professors, it's not correct to say that that's because of racism, because the correct question is, how many black Americans have PhDs in the relevant fields? So if you want to say there's a problem and we want to get more blacks into different types of occupations, well, the question becomes, get them the qualifications. Get them the relevant degree first. So, in other words, it's not enough to point fingers at the universities who would, of course, kill their own grandmothers in order to get more blacks on the faculty. I mean, of course, they all are desperate for that. But it's not their fault if there are only two black PhDs in mathematics in a given year when there were 500 PhDs awarded in mathematics, that sort of thing. That's what I'm talking about. So if you think there's something that can be done about it, you have to think about the when is that to be done. Is it to be done at the moment of the job interview? Is it to be done at the moment that a university is looking for a professor when the number of PhDs awarded, that's already occurred and there's nothing that can be done about that? So that's the sort of question that doesn't get raised. So I wanted to raise it here. I want to explain, you'll hear it in a Probably I give it a lousy explanation in the talk, but I want to explain exactly what I'm talking about at the very beginning. Tom DiLorenzo gave a hilarious talk where part of it involved what's going on at Brown University, where they have safe rooms. If somebody shows up at Brown University and says something controversial, you can go into a safe room to be protected from these dangerous ideas. And in that safe room, this is not a joke, they have cookies, they have milk, they have coloring books. They have soothing music. They have blankets and pillows and so on and on. And Tom was saying, so if Tom Woods comes to your campus, you can rush right over to that safe room. So as soon as I got up to the podium, of course, I said to everybody, all right, off to your safe room. So that's what I was driving at there. All right, let's start the talk right now. And then afterward, I've got some fun little announcements I'll give you. So here we go. Hope you enjoy it.
Our first afternoon speaker needs a little introduction, I'm sure, for most of you. Tom Woods. Do we have some of Tom Woods' show viewers, listeners here in the audience tonight? Show of hands. Wow. Welcome to all of you. This is the heavy Tom Woods crowd. You know all about his achievements, academic and otherwise, the books he's written. So instead, I'll just tout his latest venture, which is a joint effort with Bob Murphy, also an economist, in a new website and a new podcast called Contra Krugman. They're going to be doing, I believe, weekly podcasts, which are basically debunking Mr. Krugman, who writes a pop political blog for the New York Times called Conscience of a Liberal. So ContraKrugman.com is the website you need to check out. And Tom is our afternoon speaker. Tom?
Ladies and gentlemen, time to head off to your safe room. Don't say I didn't warn you. Before I get started today, and today, by the way, I'm going to cover all kinds of things that could make people uncomfortable. I'm going to talk about the so-called gender wage gap and argue that there really isn't one. I'm going to talk about all kinds of differences between all kinds of people and all kinds of groups. So fasten your seatbelt. But before I do that, I'd like to urge you to see these devices that you have. And we haven't hectored you about taking them out and turning them off. I'm actually going to hector you about taking them out and turning them on. Turn this on now, not just so you can tweet things about what I'm saying, but primarily because I'm going to give you a free book right now. It's called Bernie Sanders is Wrong. And it will be, this is a real book. It's a real e-book. It's about 150 pages, and it covers inequality, trade, renewable energy, should we be like Sweden, all these sorts of arguments that you hear. It's all in there. And I'm giving it to you because it'll actually be helpful for one of the topics I'm discussing today. So the way you get this book for free is simply to, and it comes in three formats. If you like Kindle, they'll give it to you that way. If you like PDF, EPUB, just text the name Bernie to the number 33444. So that's 33444. Text the name Bernie, and you will get the book, Bernie Sanders is Wrong. Amazing what technology makes possible. All right. I'll tell you in a minute what topic from there is going to be helpful for us this afternoon. What I want to talk about today is the narrative of oppression that underlies the whole political correctness movement. And this narrative holds certain things to be true to the point that you're not allowed to question them. Questioning them is not even considered to be a legitimate point of view. And if you should be so foolish as to question them, you will not be refuted. You will simply be hounded out of society. And we all know what I'm talking about. If you make some of the claims that I'll be making here today, you will not be met with a careful, sober, scholarly refutation. Instead, you will be hectored and called names, and your motives will be impugned. In a way, it is reminiscent of Marxism in that Marx would often say that an opponent of his was obviously simply a pawn of the bourgeois class. It was not necessary so much to refute this person. What we needed to do was unmask his class background, because then we would know that that colored all of his thinking. This man belongs to the bourgeois class. Well, likewise, it is sufficient to say, well, so-and-so is a white man. Of course he will say these things. Now, if it so happens that it's a white woman saying these things, or a black woman, or a Hispanic man, or whatever, well, those people are not even human from the point of view of the political correctness movement. They cannot conceive of why people would want to participate in their own oppression, which is the only way they can account for why people might disagree with their conclusions. The primary narrative, of course, as Tom DiLorenzo indicated, is that there is an express and oftentimes implicit oppression, a campaign of oppression against all groups other than white men throughout society. And coupled with this narrative of oppression is an expectation that in the absence of this oppression, we would have equality of economic outcomes in terms of job opportunities and incomes. And if this equality of outcome is not present, then there must be a sinister reason. There must be a deliberate attempt to bring about unequal outcomes somewhere. And what follows from this, and this is why the Mises Institute would have a particular interest in this, is that state policies
to rectify the imbalances are thereby proposed. We need state policies to overturn this outcome, to reverse this outcome, to minimize these differences, and so on. So it's not just that we're dealing with toxic and irrational ideas. These are ideas that obviously lend themselves to government intervention. We need government intervention to reverse all these outcomes that we're told are unnatural and would not occur spontaneously. But the presumption that we would have equal outcomes for all groups is based in an extremely, well, I don't know how to say this here, an approach to society that is so simplistic as to be juvenile. Because the different racial and ethnic groups in the United States differ in all sorts of ways that are completely benign. They differ in average age, for example. They differ in their geographical distribution across the country. They differ in their educational levels, and they differ in their culture and their cultural values. And they differ in these ways that are so extraordinary that it would be astonishing if there were equal outcomes among groups, even assuming absolutely pure motives on the part of everybody involved. Let's take a quick example to illustrate what I mean. Japanese American women are only 10% of them are married by age 18. But 50% of Mexican American women are married by age 18. That difference alone is going to have a lot to do with educational opportunities, job placement, and so on, because when people get married, it has an impact on these other aspects of their lives. That's just one cultural difference between two groups that right off the bat will, in a totally benign way, account for many of the differences between them. Now, we're told that if there are income differences between groups, this must mean discrimination. And if one group, let's say, earns more than another, then that group is suffering from less discrimination than the other. And then a group above them is suffering from still less discrimination. So the fact, for example, that Jewish people in the United States earn more on average than Hispanics is taken to mean that anti-Semitism must be of lower intensity than anti-Hispanic feeling. That's the explanation for why there are these differences in incomes. Well, then how do we explain the much greater incomes of Jewish people in Hispanic countries? Good question. The answer is, the question is not to be posed. If you pose the question, you're obviously a spokesman of the oppressor class and so on and on. So in other words, you can't even make an argument. The making of an argument is an act of hostility. Or, we're sometimes told that Black Americans have higher infant mortality rates, presumably because they are deprived of prenatal care. They're deprived of access to prenatal care. But Chinese Americans have even lower infant mortality than whites, even though they have less prenatal care. So there are disparities everywhere in American society and around the world. And there would and will be such disparities as long as human beings roam the earth. And there is no reason to expect otherwise. Let me give you a few examples. In 2012, out of the 100 top-ranked marathon runners, 68 were Kenyans. The National Spelling Bee has had an Indian American as the winner for 7 consecutive years. Despite being greatly outnumbered by Black Americans and slightly outnumbered by Black Americans in terms of earning bachelor's degrees, Asian Americans received more than twice as many bachelor degrees in engineering as Blacks. Moreover, Asians outnumber Blacks, despite the fact that they are vastly outnumbered by Blacks in the general population. They outnumber them at MIT 3-1, 10-1 at Harvey Mudd College, and 40-1 at Caltech. But even this, as Thomas Sowell points out, was not as great as the disparity between Chinese and Malays earning engineering degrees in Malaysia in the 1960s. Students from the Chinese minority in Malaysia, maybe 5% of the population, earned over 100 times as many engineering degrees as students from the Malay majority. And this is in a country where Malays dominate the government and they dominate university policy. So as Sowell says, there are grossly uneven and non-random outcomes from all sorts of purposeful human endeavors. Moreover, serious laws and policies are based on these assumptions that we should expect everything to be equal in defiance of the facts. The Malaysians have never, or I beg your pardon, the Chinese minority in Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Thailand have never operated under an equal playing field, and yet most of those nations' total investments in key industries are held by this Chinese minority. The Chinese minority has had twice the average income of the Malay majority, despite the fact that they've been officially discriminated against. The Italians in Argentina have outperformed native Argentines despite discrimination. The same could be said for Jews, Armenians, East Indians, and more. In the United States, Japanese Americans were so discriminated against that some of them were put into special camps during World War II. And yet, in spite of the temptation to use this as an excuse for poor performance, by 1959, Japanese-American households had equaled white households in income, and by 1969, were earning one-third more. So there are a lot of disparities, and there are disparities that are the opposite of what you would expect if the narrative of political correctness were true, that discrimination and oppression must have these sorts of outcomes. Sometimes we have exactly the opposite outcomes because human beings are widely variable and they are in many, many different sorts of circumstances. There are many factors that contribute to various outcomes. It is not, in other words, a comic book. The world is not a comic book in which there is one factor at work and in which everything would be equal if we could just get this one factor just right. Now, what about the so-called gender pay gap? We're told that women earn 77% of what men earn. That is not true. It's true in the most trivial, irrelevant sense imaginable. But it is not generally true. Now, when I was arguing this on Equal Pay Day, they have an Equal Pay Day every year, I was trying to argue this with somebody, and the person actually believes that what's being complained about is that women are earning 77% of what men earn for doing the same work. That is actually not the claim that the gender pay gap people are making. But like with the war in Iraq, where they were glad to let people think Saddam had had a hand in 9/11, even though they didn't have to come out and say that, the gender pay gap people are quite happy for people to believe that the issue is women are earning 77% of what men are earning for doing the same work. That is not the claim. Because, in fact, the Equal Pay Act of 1963 already made it illegal for women to earn less for doing the same work. That's not the issue. What they're saying is that if you add up all the hours that women work in all different occupations, and you add up all the hours that men work, and you divide the one into the other, the answer is 77%. So you might ask yourself, well, what kind of jobs do they have? Might that have a little to do with the difference? Do they have different kinds of jobs in general? What are their degrees in? Are women getting degrees in engineering more often than men, or are they getting degrees in education more often than men? Which one pays better? How many hours are they working? Can you believe that's not factored in? That's not even factored in. They say, well, we're dealing with full-time workers. That's an equivocation. Full-time, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, means you work in the vicinity of 40 to 41 hours plus. Or no, I beg your pardon, it's 35 hours now. They now say 35 hours plus means you're working full time. Well, let's disaggregate those statistics. Let's see how many of those people are working just 35 to 39 hours. 12% of women are working 35 to 39 hours per week. And 5% of men are working 35 to 39. How many are working 41 hours plus? 26% of men are working 41 hours plus. Only 14% of women are working 41 hours plus. So when you factor in the number of hours worked, the so-called 23% pay gap drops immediately to 12%. Just with that one adjustment. Now, how could they not know that, right? That's an obvious lie. Are they that pathetic and uninformed? They don't even know the difference in hours worked. They're going to make a big federal case out of this whole thing, and they're not even measuring hours worked? No, I don't believe that. They're obviously lying because they don't care about the facts. They honestly do not care. I remember when I was in academia, year after year, I would say, gosh, I mean, I've got all the facts and statistics here. What do they care? What they care about is power. They don't care about these statistics. Now, what's interesting is, we still have a 12% pay gap to account for. But you know what institution in the United States, a very prominent institution, also has a 12% gender pay gap? The Obama White House. Now, they're going to go around and harass private employers all day long about having a 12% pay gap. So it was raised to Jay Carney. Well, hey, I mean, you guys have a 12% pay gap. How do you account for that? And you know what the answer was? Well, you know, I mean, women have different jobs in the White House than men. You don't say. That's the point. All right, well, where's the 12% coming from? Again, there are many possible reasons. But one of them, of course, is the difference in effects on men and women of marriage. Marriage and childbearing. If a woman expects to be out of the labor force for an extended period of time to raise a family, this automatically rules out certain high-paying occupations where your knowledge would be simply out of date by the time you returned. So there are some high-paying types of careers that are immediately ruled out. Moreover, there are other careers where there are a lot of people packing into them because they're so desirable from the point of view of a woman with children, like education or being a secretary where you can make hours that are very friendly and family friendly. So this is entirely benign. These are the ways people sort themselves out. And these particular jobs tend to have lower salaries. But this is not any sinister plot to keep women down. Obviously, if women were only earning 77% of what men earned, every business, you know how razor-thin profit margins are these days? They would drop every man on the payroll in a second and hire women. I mean, to get a 23% advantage over your competitors? It's so funny how these same people spend all their time talking about how greedy the private sector is. And they don't stop to realize if they were that greedy and there really were a 23% pay gap, there'd be no male employees. They would all have been fired. Hello? So I cover this in that Bernie Sanders is Wrong book. So there's all these statistics and much more analyzing that is all in there. It's important, by the way, to disaggregate statistics to understand what's really going on. It's not enough to say, well, there must be some discrimination because white PhDs are earning more than black PhDs or Asian PhDs are earning more. Well, the question would be, what are the PhDs in? Are the PhDs in chemistry, in mathematics, and in engineering, as most of the Asian PhDs are, which these are very high-paying fields? Or at least 50% of black PhDs are in education, which is a notoriously low-paying field. Might this account for the disparity we're seeing? Wouldn't that be a better way to try to think about this than to assume there's a deliberate, hate-filled campaign against black PhDs in the United States? Why would that be your automatic default position, to assume the absolute worst of your fellow human beings? Educational differences can also account for later outcomes in life. And here we have an enormous amount of material that we can cover, so I'll keep it as limited as I can. There was a study in the late 1990s. It was the NAEP. I think it was the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Big thing, fully funded. And what it found that after billions of dollars had been spent on busing programs and so on and on, they found that the average black student who was about to complete his senior year of high school was slightly lower in reading and U.S. history than the average white eighth grader, and was far below the average white eighth grader in math and geography. They saw that the progress between 1977 and 1999 among black students in science was they went from the 8th percentile to the 10th percentile. In the year 2001, they found that the math SAT, on the math SAT, the number of black students scoring 700 or above in the entire country was 700. Whereas Asians, vastly outnumbered by black students, had over 16,000 such students. It was found that even in the early years, beginning in kindergarten, there are disparities. So this is long before there could be other sorts of influences. So, for example, the National Center for Educational Statistics found that black students entering kindergarten were already disproportionately testing in the bottom quarter of students in reading, math, and general knowledge, that between one-third and one-half of black students were testing that low, but only one-sixth of whites. They also noted behavioral disparities requiring discipline, also evident at that early age. And this has sometimes been attributed to racist white teachers who just arbitrarily pick out the black students. But to the contrary, they found that black teachers are even tougher on the black students than the white ones are. This gap persists even when social class is accounted for. Yes, obviously people who are raised in a wealthier environment do better, but that's true of whites also. So the gap is still basically the same. It's only marginally different. And there is a study done of an affluent Cleveland suburb called Shaker Heights, Ohio. This is where the high school spends about 50% more than the national average. And the town's black residents have only slightly below the white residents in terms of education and income levels. In this school, anybody can take advanced placement classes. You can take any class you want. So there was a special effort to get the black students to take the advanced placement classes. 30% of them do, but 87% of the white students do. Two-thirds of the city's black students were failing at least one of the Ohio State proficiency tests. This was true only of one-sixth of whites. Over half of whites passed the tests with honors. This was true of 4% of black students. And as Stefan Thernstrom points out, he was my professor at Harvard, that number, 4%, is no higher than the statewide average for blacks, despite the fact that income and educational levels of black families in Shaker Heights were far above those for Ohio as a whole, and children attending integrated school, they were attending integrated schools that were regarded among the best in the state. Well, these are facts. You know, as I say, you're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. So therefore, we need political action is the remedy that's proposed by the politically correct movement. Obviously, we need state action to deal with problems like this, to deal with disparities, to deal with income disparities, to deal with whatever. We need state action. But one thing Sowell has pointed out as he has studied groups, ethnic groups all over the world, is that actually it's the most successful minority ethnic and racial groups that are not involved in politics at all. He said, for example, if you look in the United States, look at the groups that got ahead. They didn't get involved in politics till after they got ahead. But look at the groups that lagged behind the most, the Irish, for example. The Irish had political machines, they did everything to get involved in politics, and they were the slowest to advance. In Detroit, you had blacks elected at every single conceivable level of government. A lot of good it did them. How about the Chinese in the United States? Only after they became affluent did the Chinese begin to get involved in politics. And even then, they campaigned on platforms of advancing the general welfare, not being obsessed with their race. This is true also of the Chinese in Southeast Asia and in the Caribbean. It's true of the Germans in the United States. It's true of the Germans in Brazil, and it's true of the Germans in Australia. English immigrants in Argentina have been very prosperous, but played next to no role in Argentine politics. For a very long time, Italians were notorious for not participating in American politics and even for choosing non-Italians over Italians. In fact, in 1940, the best known elected official, Italian elected official in the U.S., Fiorello LaGuardia, lost the Italian vote to his Irish competitor. Now, even when government has gotten involved in the United States, the outcomes, of course, as you can predict, have been terrible. In 1948, when the minimum wage hadn't been adjusted for inflation, so it was basically lower than the typical wage everybody was earning anyway, so it really was not even a factor. There may as well have been no minimum wage in 1948. Black teen unemployment was under 10%. Then they started increasing the minimum wage. That was the last time black teen unemployment would ever be below 20%. By the 1970s, it was around 47%, and it tracks the increase in the minimum wage very closely. Or, of course, there's been a lot talked about how the welfare state encourages all kinds of pathological behavior and all kinds of unhealthy behavior. It encourages the opposite of the sorts of virtues we would want to see encouraged. And people say, yeah, I sort of accept that. But the fact is, in the 1920s in New York, you know the percentage of families, black families, headed by a single woman? 3%. So much for the legacy of slavery argument. How could the legacy of slavery be worse the farther away in time you get from slavery? From 1940 to 1960, the black poverty rate declined 87% to 47%. How did it do that? 40 percentage points. That's before there was a war on poverty. That was before there was a great society. It was before any of these things. It was migration, black migration. That was what solved it. Now, it's true that you do see a continued 18% decline in the poverty rate. That's not insubstantial later on. But this is an already existing trend. And if I had a little more time, I would tell you about already existing trends in black employment before the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Already existing. We see greater gains in employment in the 1950s and 40s. Than in the 1960s. No one tells you that because that would undermine the narrative. We can't have that. So the argument just becomes that blacks owe everything they have to the government. These are already existing trends. Everything you can think of was an already existing trend. All right, now I do want to leave you with we're bombarded with falsehoods that are easily refuted, and we got to figure out what to do about them. Before I do that, I do want to point out one little thing, though, that I forgot to mention, just because it was so big when I was in school. When I was in college, a big issue on campus was faculty diversity. And we were told, and we heard this over and over again, the fact we don't have more black professors at Harvard is an indication of a deep-seated racism at the university. So they don't hesitate to accuse people of the basest motives imaginable. Just immediately, automatically assume that. So I wrote an article about this at the time, and I pointed out that I don't think it's because Harvard doesn't want more black professors. Every Harvard administrator would step over his own grandmother, putting his boot right in her face to get more black faculty. Are you insane? The reason we haven't got it is that you just look at the numbers. In 1988, because I entered in 1990, the number of people awarded PhDs in math and computers was 608 to be precise. Of those, two were black. How many of those is Harvard going to be able to hire? How many and we can go into a lot of other scientific fields where the number is also extremely low. Even in U.S. history, 5, and that includes African-American history, 5. How many colleges and universities are there? Do the math. And it goes on. And then there are entire fields, dozens of them, with zero black PhDs at all. Now, you can say this is because they didn't have adequate opportunity. Whatever the explanation for that is, this is not the moment to deal with it. Deal with it earlier. But it's certainly to go around saying that you are bad because you just don't want different people here at the university is just morally wrong and despicable and disgusting. To basically use career-destroying smears to try to advance your so-called argument, which has, as usual, zero statistics behind it. All right, so what do we do? Well, it's true, as Tom DiLorenzo says, we can ridicule these people. That's easy, because they're so ridiculously wrong on everything. And then they just double down. They're really wrong, and then they just they go out of their way. We can't have anyone come to campus to talk about how wrong we are. We'll all sit, as Tom DiLorenzo says about Brown University, we'll sit in our safe room with our pillow and blanket and our coloring book. And if people watching on YouTube, that's actually what they have at Brown University. Literally, they have coloring books, they have cookies in there to make you feel better. Well, I would need that too if I were being demolished so badly in a debate. Give me my pillow and blanket. But we can do more than this. First of all, anytime there's any article pushing the PC agenda, this is the only time I ever recommend you read the comments section in the internet. The only time it's ever going to make you feel better. No one's buying it. No one's buying it. They've been playing this tune for too long. But there are two other practical things, because I want to say, what are practical things we can do? One is, of course, a thing that I've had the chance to work on for a couple of years, and that's Ron Paul's homeschool program. RonPaulHomeschool.com is something I devoted 2 years of my life to. And if people are exposed to, have a chance to hear an alternative, they hear the standard worldview and a different one, like namely ours, which is what they'll also get a chance to hear in this curriculum, they'll be less likely to be swept away by political correctness. They won't buy into it because they'll have the analytical tools and the knowledge to know where it goes wrong. That'll help. And secondly, of course, the Mises Institute, which is utterly fearless, which is smeared by everybody you would want it to be smeared by, attacked by everybody whose attacks are medals on its chest. Every time it's attacked, you say, ah, my donation to the Mises Institute is secure. Would never dream of doing anything other than help the Mises Institute more. Because that's what we need. It's not people who go scurrying for the exits because the New York Times called them a name. If the New York Times is inviting you to write a column for them, that means you're their lapdog. The Mises Institute isn't anybody's lapdog. It believes in truth. It'll follow that truth wherever it takes us. And that's why I commend it to you so strongly, and I'm so proud to say that I've been connected with the Mises Institute as a student and now in my present career capacity for over 20 years, and I invite you to join me. Thank you very much.
All right, here are my announcements. First one is, a bunch of episodes ago, I promoted a foreign language study course called Rocket Languages. They've got all different languages that you might want to learn, and it's very effective, and it's less expensive than Rosetta Stone and some of the other ones. Well, I happen to know, because I'm clued into them, that this coming Monday, October 12th, they're having an exclusive one-day sale where they're cutting the prices by 60%. Just for that one day, or just until they sell 1,000 courses in that day. Once they sell 1,000 courses, the sale is over. So I want you to get a head start on this. TomWoods.com/rocket will get you over there and get you a free mini course in one of these languages. But that's the link you want to use on Monday to get over there, grab your 60% off course, set yourself a reminder on Google Calendar, TomWoods.com/rocket. Secondly, coming up on Tuesday, October 13th, 2015, is my free webinar that has to do in part with being successful online in business. If you have a business that's totally online or partially online, you need to know how to build an email list, or you are leaving money on the table or throwing it out the window. And I know a little something about this, so I'm going to share with you what I've learned, strategies that have worked for me that you can use as soon as the webinar is over. You don't have to buy anything to be able to use these strategies. So join me for that webinar. Sign up for the webinar at tomwoods.com/email webinar. Also at tomwoods.com/508, today's show notes page, I will link to a sign-up link for the webinar. Do please join me. It's going to be Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Also on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/508, I'm going to list three books that are useful if you want to know more about the sorts of points that I was making in the talk today. One of them is Thomas Sowell's book, Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality. The second one is his brand new book, Wealth, Poverty, and Politics, an International Perspective. And the third one is my own book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. I'm going to link to all of these books. If you're interested in any of this material, those are the books you want to read. So that's at tomwoods.com/508. Finally, Contra Krugman, the podcast that demolishes Paul Krugman every single week, has launched. And you can check it out at ContraKrugman.com, where you can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, as you do for this show. I know you're going to love it. It's only one episode a week, and so you can easily catch up on them. We've got three episodes up now. Actually, by the time you get there, it'll be four episodes, probably. So we're really excited about it. I hope you will be, too. So that's a lot to keep track of, but it'll all be at TomWoods.com/508. The books, the webinar, the Rocket Languages reminder, and the Contra Krugman podcast. How about that? So make sure and check those things out, and we'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.